Welcome to Sundays with Papa Jeff. If you're listening live, this is bbsradio.com, and my name is Jeff Bellier. If you're listening to the CD or MP3, welcome to part two of the audiobook version of Sunrise at Two Lions. In the tradition of the to-be-continued genre, I'll recap part one and repeat a bit of part one as we begin part two. Those of you who are not familiar with Sunrise at Two Lions or haven't listened to the first part, Sunrise at Two Lions is a book of visionary fiction. It's told by a mysterious unnamed storyteller to the writer of this book. And it is about a young boy named Billy King Frazier, age 10, who goes missing one winter in Maine and 90 days later reappears with an incredibly surprising story for his family. He had gone ice fishing with his father and had fallen through the ice and was stuck under the ice and went through a near-death experience. And in the spring, when the ice melted, he burst out of the water and came back to his family. And he began to tell the story, and his grandfather, he lived with his grandmother and grandpa, and his grandfather absolutely freaked out about the story. His mother and father are divorced, and his mother had been in Florida but came home when Billy was missing. And so now Billy has just begun to tell his story, and he's telling what happened to him after this, in the midst of this near-death experience, but no one wants to listen really other than his grandmother, his Nana. And he is talking about arriving at in part one he talked about arriving at this big castle, and he's just met this man named William, and Billy is talking to his grandmother. And I'll pick up a little bit of part one, and then we'll go into part two. This is Billy talking, age 10, and the tone of the story is from a 10-year-old at this point. And now Billy is speaking. By now I had forgotten all about falling through the ice and the light and everything, and it just felt right to be here at this big castle, this big house. Somehow I knew I was supposed to be there, or at least I didn't think about it. William made me feel safe. It was like he was there to protect me or teach me something. Anyway, I felt really good. It was like I was in a different world. Well, I guess I was in a different world. William put his arm around my shoulder and said, "Let's go inside. Everybody's waiting for you." I still didn't know what he meant, but I was feeling really good and happy, so I started up the front stairs with William. As we went past the lions, the one on the other side of the steps winked at me and whispered, "See you later, Billy." I asked William if he heard that. He nodded his head and told me not to pay any attention to the lions. Now, the lions are stone lions. The theme of the story essentially is that stone lions can't move and can't bother you unless you stop and listen to them. When we went inside, I could smell apple pie cooking. It smelled just like yours, Nana. And I thought for a minute that I was back home, but I wasn't. The house was big and bright with really nice high ceilings. I could hear music coming from somewhere, like the music I heard earlier when I first fell through the ice. Went through a big kitchen and then into a room like a porch. The porch had big windows and I could see the ocean about 100 yards away. When we stepped out onto the porch, I saw a bunch of people sitting around a big long table, and some others sitting on chairs, and a few more people sitting on a long blue couch. There were 11 people there. They all said, "Hi, Billy," at the same time. I don't know why, but I started laughing again. I wasn't scared this time. I felt it was my birthday party or something. William took me around to each person and introduced me. I'll tell you the names later when I tell you the stories they each had for me. William told me that while I was with them, I was going to hear 12 stories, one from each of the people I was meeting and one from him. He told me that he was going to tell me about the two lions and that he would remind me of this story after each of the stories I was about to hear. But first he said he was going to show me my room upstairs. I started asking him a whole bunch of questions, but he just said that I would see. "You'll see, Billy, you'll see." That's all he would say each time I asked him a question, so I just stopped asking for a while. My room was a big white room with a king-size bed. Two big windows looked out over the ocean, and I could see the white caps and hear one after another crash up on the beach. I noticed that even small waves made a pretty big crash sound as they turned over and hit the beach. I could see little islands out in the ocean not far from shore. I could smell the ocean air, and I could see seagulls flying around close to shore. Sometimes a lot of them would gather, and if one came up from the ocean with food or anything in its beak, the others would all try to get it. It really made a racket. It was fun to watch, and it made me laugh. Up on the sand, I saw little birds with long, skinny legs, and they would scurry really fast. Their legs just made a blur. They made me laugh, too. Everything seemed to just make me want to laugh. Everything made me so happy. When I looked around the room, I saw a lot of paintings on the walls. The colors were really bright, and they looked like what I saw when I looked out over the ocean. Well, they sort of looked like the ocean, but there were a lot of colors in them that I didn't see out on the water. I looked back and forth at the paintings in the ocean a few times. I was looking out over the water, just watching and listening, when the smell of that apple pie I mentioned got really strong. I turned around, and there was a young girl about my age standing there with a slice of pie and a big glass of milk. She said to me, "Nana sent this up to you." It really surprised me. I thought she meant you, but I guess it was her Nana. Anyway, I ate the pie and drank the milk. It was delicious. I remember every bite of that sweet, warm apple pie. The crust was just like yours, Nana. The milk tasted like the taste in my mouth that I tasted when I first fell through the ice. It seemed that everything that was happening kept reminding me of those few minutes after I fell through the ice. Then I lay down on the big bed, and I guess I went to sleep. I must have slept really well, because the next thing I knew, William was shaking me to wake up. After I got up and took a shower in the bathroom right next to my room, I went back to my room to get dressed, and there were clean clothes, all ironed and laid out for me. As I was getting dressed, I looked out the windows of my room. The sun was just coming up over the ocean. The colors in the sky and on the water were like colors I'd never seen. I snapped my head around to look at the paintings in my room again, and then back out at the sunrise. This time, I saw a lot of the colors that were in the paintings on the walls. I finished getting dressed and went downstairs. I found William and Anna, that was a girl who brought me the pie, another woman and an older man named Wolfgang sitting on the porch eating breakfast. Everybody said, "Hi, Billy, your breakfast is ready," at the same time. When I heard them say that, it was like all of a sudden I was supposed to be there, and I knew them, and they knew me. Don't ask me how I knew that, I just did. It didn't even occur to me to ask where I was, why I was there, anything. It just seemed right, and I was feeling really happy to be there, so I sat right down. The breakfast table was covered with a white tablecloth, and the table was loaded with pastries that were filled with bright lemon fillings and deep red raspberry-colored fillings, blueberry fillings, and there were all kinds of fresh fruit all cut up, a big clear glass pitcher of orange juice, another one filled with cranberry juice right beside it. The colors from the morning sky came in through the big window and mixed with all the colors on the breakfast table. I could see the colors from the paintings in my room everywhere on the table. I was happy and feeling safe, but then I got a little scared when I sat down and looked at my plate. I saw a reflection of one of those lions from the front steps looking back at me from the white plate. He didn't say anything this time, but I felt scared again for a second. That feeling went away as soon as I put a lemon pastry on my plate. When I started to eat, everything tasted better than anything I ever tasted. Nobody said hardly anything all through breakfast. They just smiled at each other and smiled at me. We all looked out at the sunrise and watched the changing colors of pink and peach and gold and blue in the morning sky, and then looked at each other and just smiled. It was fun doing that. Anna giggled once. As soon as we finished breakfast, William asked me to take a walk with him. We went out through the kitchen and onto the front steps. The lions were there in their usual places. I kind of expected them to say something or do something as we went by and walked down the stairs, but they didn't. We walked into a forest of mostly pine trees and white birches. There weren't many trees. Everything was open, and the sunlight came through the branches and leaves in streams of light all over the place. It felt magical. The ground was covered with leaves and pine needles. We saw a few chipmunks and squirrels as we walked. Pretty soon, we came to a patch of light green moss with some of those little white flowers that you showed me. "Queen Anne's lace," Nana said softly, breaking the spell she had been under. She had been totally entranced by Billy's story, and she was as much entranced by the details of the story as she was by the way Billy was telling it. The way he described his experiences, the colors, the sounds, the setting, the taste, all with this look of sheer delight on his face that she had never seen before, just stunned her. Billy was definitely changed by his experience, whatever had happened to him. Billy smiled at her and nodded acknowledgement when she told him the name of the little white flowers and went right back to his story. So anyway, William and I sat down on the moss and just enjoyed the warm sun. We didn't talk or anything for the longest time. It just felt so peaceful and nice. After a little while, I leaned back on the moss and stared up through the trees to the sky, and William began to tell me a story. He told me that the two stone lions on the steps of the house were originally put there to protect the house and everyone who came into it and scare away anyone or anything that would come near the house that could hurt anyone in any way. They were supposed to just scare away anyone who didn't belong there, but after a while, things changed. The lions would roar and scare anyone who came by, even the people who came to visit or came to live at the house. After a few years, they even began to talk to people coming by them. What was even stranger, one of them seemed to know everything about everybody's life, especially anything they did wrong. And the other knew how to really scare everyone. It was like they knew everyone, and they knew every detail of their secret fears and doubts. And they were really mean about it. William explained to me that we all have things in our lives that we wish we hadn't done or hadn't said. And the most everyone has some doubts at times about who they really are and what they're really all about and what their purpose is in life. I told him that I bet just about everyone was scared of snakes and spiders in the dark when they were kids. He said a lot of grown-ups are still scared of snakes and spiders in the dark and lots of other things. They try to act brave and like these things don't bother them, but they don't fool the lions. I asked him why the lions scared everybody when they were just supposed to protect the house and the people in it. William told me that the lions figured out that a good way to protect someone is to make them afraid of doing things that are dangerous or that might be beyond their abilities. That way they will stay safe. So they started telling everybody who came by to watch out for this and watch out for that and not try something that would possibly hurt them. But pretty soon they were warning people coming by about every little thing that wasn't part of their daily routine. And if they wouldn't listen, then the lions would remind them of a time that they got hurt or did something bad to try to keep them from doing anything new or making any mistakes. William said the lions were like overprotective parents and teachers. They meant well at first, but then they started controlling so much that they got everybody afraid to try anything and doubting their ability to do just about anything. Even worse, they made the people they were trying to protect feel really bad about themselves inside. I wonder how anybody ever dared to try anything new or get to feel better about themselves after making a lot of mistakes or doing something really bad if the lions wouldn't let them forget what they had done. And I asked William about that. He told me that I would have my answer if I would listen carefully. Did you ever worry about something and get all in a fret about it and it never happened? William asked me. Sure, lots of times, I said. One time I broke a glass in the kitchen when I was getting some milk, and I heard Grandpa yell when he heard it break. I told him how worried I was that Grandpa was going to get all mad and upset and ground me and everything, but after all the fretting I did, this time Grandpa just let it go without being upset at all. And I told about coming home late from school one time, another time thinking I had failed a math test, and then about getting picked on and rescued before anything happened. I had a lot of stories about worrying and being scared of something that didn't happen the way I thought it would. William just listened patiently, and then he told me something about the lions. He told me once again that the lions are not real. They can talk and all, but they can't really move or do anything directly. And they can only talk if we are around to listen to them, and if we stop and listen to them, they will talk and talk and talk. I was wondering what this had to do with worrying about stuff that never really happened when William told me the name of the lions. He told me that the lion on the left was Furman. He's a lion of fear. Furman likes to fret. He's always worried about what's going to happen in the future, what happened in the past, and what other people will think. He's always afraid. He's always worried. On the right, William went on, is Dunbar. Dunbar is the lion of doubt. He's a lot like Furman, except it's not so much fear as indecision that he talks about all the time. Should I do this? Should I do that? What if I do this? What if I don't do this? How will I feel if I do it? How will I feel if I don't do it? How will I feel after I do it or after I don't? What do I want to do with my life? And he, too, worries a lot about what other people will think. He worries that they won't like him, or they'll think he's strange or different. I just kind of laughed and told him that if these lions were just made of stone and they couldn't do anything, what did we have to fear from them anyway? He told me that we didn't have anything to fear. It was just that when we stop and listen to them, we listen to fear and doubt that they put in us. William reminded me of how he had told me that the lions were originally there on the steps leading into the house to protect people who lived in the house, but they got too big for their britches, and instead of just protecting the people from anything that would hurt them from the outside, they started to warn the people in the house about every little thing. And then it just went on from there. They started talking and talking to everyone who went into the house and causing worry and doubt about everything. Oh yeah, I said, I'm beginning to understand. So fear and doubt are supposed to protect us, but if we let them, they'll try to take over and make us worry about stuff we don't have to worry about, right? He told me I was exactly right. But that there is a way to tame the lions, and he would tell me, but it was getting late, and we needed to get back to the house. He said he would tell me later. So we got up from the moss and headed back to the house. I couldn't believe it was getting dark. It seemed like we had just got there. On the way back to the house, William asked me if I had seen the paintings in my room, and I told him that I had, and I liked them, and I saw their colors everywhere. He asked me if I had a favorite painting, but I didn't. Then he asked me if I would go to my room when we got back to the house, and pick any one of the paintings of my choice and come and tell him which one I had picked first. I told him I would. Billy King Frazier, a voice bellowed from outside, snapping Billy and Anna out of the story. It was Rachel, Billy's mom. She was standing in the driveway beside a taxi cab, and there were several other people with her. There were reporters and photographers who had been following Rachel around all day. She decided to get it over with and let them talk to Billy. Billy, we have to talk. Come outside, Rachel demanded in a tone that only she could project. Billy just shrugged, looked at his grandmother, and walked out to meet his mother and the reporters. He saw the worried look in his mother's eyes. Chapter 5, Billy's Other Story. I don't remember. I just remember falling through the ice and being really cold, Billy said to the reporters and photographers. I broke through the ice and crawled back up on the pine needles. It was really cold. That's all I remember until Mrs. Littlefield picked me up and took me back to Nana's. The reporters from the newspapers and radio and TV stations pressed and pressed Billy for more information, but he had decided to do what his mother wanted and not say anything to anyone outside of the family. She was really relieved. With that, Rachel took her bags out of the taxi and followed Billy back into the house. She gave her mother a look that her mother knew well. It was yet another victory for Rachel. She got her way once again. But then something different happened. Rachel stopped and gave her mother a light, tight squeeze. Nana started to walk away. She couldn't remember the last time that Rachel gave her a hug, not since Rachel was a girl, not since her grandmother's funeral. Nana felt a tear from Rachel, wet against her cheek, but she didn't say anything. Neither did Rachel. She zipped into her room and didn't come out for an hour or so. When she did come out, she kind of floated. She brushed by Billy, giving him a wink and a rub across his back as she walked by him. Billy smiled at her, and he could feel something very different. His mother looked softer and more relaxed than he'd ever seen her. Thank you, Billy, was all she said. That afternoon, Billy came down with the flu. He started getting chills, and Nana wrapped him up in a couple of blankets on the couch. But he just couldn't get warm. Then he'd get really hot and sweaty and throw the blankets on the floor. Rachel came into the living room where Billy was on the couch during one of his hot and sweaty spells. She put a hand on his forehead and hollered to Nana that Billy was, quote, burning up. Nana resisted, of course, but Rachel insisted that they call Dr. Matthews. When Dr. Matthews came over, he asked Billy if he had remembered any more of what happened to him during the winter. Rachel and Nana were in the room when Dr. Matthews asked Billy this question. He looked at them both and didn't say anything. He just shook his head from side to side a little. Dr. Matthews told Rachel and Nana not to worry. It was just a flu bug. As for Billy's memory of what happened, Dr. Matthews told him that they may never know. He thought Billy might have wandered into the woods and found a cabin with enough food to get him through the winter. The good doctor offered that Billy was probably so frightened that he had put the whole thing out of his mind, maybe even permanently. Calls and letters and notes came in from all over for a few weeks, but Billy stuck with his story. He just didn't remember anything. He asked Nana not to ask him about what happened for a while, and she reluctantly kept quiet about it. Pretty soon, the whole thing just kind of died down, and Billy went back to school. Now, Billy had been a C student through most of school, with a rare A, if he really liked the subject. He was kind of lazy about school, like his father. But when he came back to school after being out for so long, it was like he came back with a new brain. He got caught up on all of his subjects in about 2 weeks. He got 100 on his first math test, and when he turned in his first book report, his English teacher accused him of having his mother or grandmother write his report. But they didn't, and Billy took home straight A's for the rest of the year. When baseball season came around, Billy tried out for Little League. He had played for a couple of years, but he was mostly put into right field for the last couple of innings if the team was way ahead. And if he ever got up to bat, the coaches would invariably tell him not to swing the bat, just wait for a walk. This year, however, everything changed. Billy could throw almost twice as far as the year before, and the first time he came up to bat in practice, he almost cleared the center field fence. The center fielder had come way in with Billy up to bat and couldn't do anything but watch the ball fly 20 feet or so over his head. And the funniest thing of all was that somehow Billy could really dance. Up until now, he went to school dances, but he didn't do much of anything but hang around the soda machine, talk to the other guys who didn't dance, and nurse a couple of Pepsis until the dance was over. The few times he went out on the dance floor before were when one of the teachers would push for ladies' choice and Billy had to go out to dance. But back then, he would just kind of shuffle his feet and look down self-consciously. The first time he went to a dance after coming back from his mysterious disappearance, he started to dance by himself almost as soon as the first record started playing. And he was really good. It didn't take long for one of the girls to notice, and he got pulled out on the dance floor in a flash. So not only was Billy somehow smarter, He was a better athlete and dancer. He was more coordinated and graceful. And everyone was amazed, especially Billy. What the heck had happened to Billy King Frazier, everyone wondered. He's changed so much, and he seems to always have this little smile, they said. Billy just said he couldn't remember. The stories that went around town, Lord in heaven, like you wouldn't believe. Everything from Billy was found and nurtured by wolves or bears, or some old hermit in the woods must have found him, or he was abducted by aliens, and who knows what else. People did talk about a glow that you could see around Billy if you looked just right around sunset. It was kind of a golden, peach-colored light. That kind of kept the alien abduction story going for a while, but that too died down. Rachel was vigilant to keep the tabloids away. She and Billy had a pact, and they both kept it. The only person he told even a part of the story to for months was his grandmother. Rachel was beginning to pick up on some of the things she heard Billy say, and she certainly noticed the changes in him. And once in a while, she would ask him a little bit about what happened, but she always approached the subject pretty cautiously. Grandpa and Ron heard bits and pieces, but it made them both really uneasy, so Billy was careful to only talk to Nana most of the time. Rachel felt the need to stick around and stay with Billy after his episode, and she stopped traveling around the world altogether. She and Billy finally got to know each other. He was more like the parent, and she was more like the child. You could see that, but it worked for them, and they got closer and closer the more time they spent together. Not only that, Rachel and Ron, Billy's mother and father, got back together. And this will floor you. Grandpa and Billy began to spend a lot of time together. Don't get up off the floor yet, because Grandpa also started bringing flowers home for Nana every Friday. Really, he did. Every Friday, he showed up with this schoolboy grin, flowers in hand. When Nana just made the biggest deal of it, she was flabbergasted and delighted. That grouch was beginning to become a softie. Probably always had been. A lot of grouches are like that. They don't let you see their soft side because they're afraid they'll be seen as weak or not taken seriously or not seen as intelligent. Maybe Billy somehow brought this side out in Grandpa. Ron came over more often than he used to before Rachel came home to stay. And of course, after Billy's adventure, Grandpa never questioned Ron's coming into the house. It was like he just forgot about the past and Ron and Rachel eloping and all. At first, Ron would spend all his time with Billy. Then he'd go into Billy's room or in the living room if no one else was around. But after a few weeks, Ron would spend a little time with Billy, and then Ron and Rachel would talk. A few minutes here and there, and then an hour, and eventually they'd talk way into the night. It wasn't long before they were, quote, dating again. Billy and Nana would cross their fingers and look at each other, each knowing what the other was thinking every time they saw Ron and Rachel go out together. Grandpa would scowl and burst out laughing. Nana's eyes would tear up, hearing Grandpa laugh again. He had been such a tyrant for so long. Nana knew something had changed in him. Maybe Billy's glow was affecting everyone. And so early one morning, before Grandpa headed off to work, Ron showed up. Rachel got up too, which was very strange for the sleepyhead, who could sack in until noon. Grandpa and Nana knew something was up. "Can I go wake Billy up?" Ron asked. He was up the stairs before anyone could respond. He came back down carrying Billy, who was rubbing his eyes and blinking. But Nana saw his repressed smile. Billy knew something was up too. And he was pretty sure he knew what it was all about. Ron took a deep breath, looked over at Rachel like a lovesick teenager, and announced to them all that he and Rachel were going to get married again. Nana let out a whoop. Grandpa frowned at her childish behavior for a split second, then caught himself. He began to nod his head affirmatively and stood up and literally lifted Ron up out of his chair. Everyone stopped. No one was even breathing. Then Grandpa gave Ron a big bear hug. "I was thinking that it might be time to winterize the camp," Grandpa said after he let Ron go. "Rachel, you and Ron have any interest in having the camp if we make it year-round? Make an awfully nice home for you kids, and I know Billy loves it out there." Rachel and Ron just looked at him with their mouths wide open. Then they looked at each other and started laughing and crying at the same time. Billy joined them in a three-way hug. "Oh, my God, Daddy," Rachel cried. Now, she hadn't called her father Daddy since she was 5 years old. "We used to talk about that would be where we would live someday when we got way back when we were in high school together." Now it was Nana's turn to sit up with her mouth open. She mumbled something about knowing they would live at the camp someday as she got up to put on some tea. She was back to everyone, and you could hear her begin to giggle. It got louder. Then it broke out in funny laughter. And that just ignited everyone, especially Billy. Can you imagine the joy that must have rung through that house? They laughed until the tea kettle whistle grew loud enough to get everyone's attention. It was like a referee's whistle. They all stopped laughing finally. And you can guess that Nana was about to do a tea leaf reading, right? Yep, there it was, plain as the nose on your face, the camp on the lake and a perfect dollar sign on the side of the cup. See, can you see it? Right here, right there. There's prosperity and a peaceful, loving home, Nana squealed in that high-pitched voice that went up when she was excited. Grandpa went off to work, and Ron and Rachel went right to work on plans for their new home. Nana, Rachel, and Ron took turns saying, "Can you believe it?" to each other. Billy went back up to bed, but he couldn't sleep. His family was back together. The next thing he heard was a scream. Came from Ron's mother. Nana told her what was going on, and it was Grammy's turn to go hysterical with the good news after good news. Billy got up and came downstairs. "Did you hear, Billy?" his grandmother asked, as she snatched him up by his arms and swung him around. "Yeah, Grammy, of course. How could I not hear?" was Billy's reply. "Aren't you happy? Aren't you happy? Aren't you happy?" she kept saying. She wasn't looking for an answer. She knew the answer. And as she did almost every time she came across the street, Grammy suddenly remembered that she left something on the stove and went running back. You could see her waving her arms and kind of dancing all the way across the street and up the front stairs to her house. Billy asked Nana if he could stay home from school that day. He was still tired from getting up too early. Now, Nana knew that Ron and Rachel were going out to the lake to work on the plans for the dream house, and she and Billy would have time to talk. Nana was pretty sure that this new turn of events would open the way for Billy to tell more of what happened to him. You know, with Rachel and Ron being busy and all the new plans and all, so Nana happily agreed with that Billy must be really tired and should stay home. There are only a few more school days left anyway. When Ron and Rachel turned into the graveled road leading down to the camp, all sorts of memories came flooding back. This had been their hideout, and if the truth were known, it had always been their love nest. They parked the Jeep at the bottom of the hill and got out to stroll along the lake, stopping to hug each other tightly without saying a word every so often. They didn't need to say anything. They could feel each other's heart pounding. It was early June by now, and the days were pretty warm. The water in the lake was still pretty cool, though. Even the warm spot in the clearing hadn't reached anywhere near swimming temperatures. "Ah, can you believe it?" Ron said again. "We're going to live out here on the lake." Rachel heard him, but her mind had taken a turn as she stopped to look out over the lake. A sudden warm feeling came over her, and her mind was definitely somewhere else. "What do you think really happened to Billy?" she asked quietly as she looked out on the very spot where Billy fell through the ice. "He couldn't have lived out here for 3 months. I really want to know, but it just scares me so much when he starts talking about being with God and everything. It just makes me crazy." Ron shook his head as if to say he didn't know. Rachel continued to look out over the water for another minute or so, then snapped out of it. She grabbed Ron's arm and pulled him toward the camp. They walked a couple of steps. Then she let go of his hand and broke into a run. The race was on. She beat Ron by 2 steps as they hit the porch steps. But he caught her by the waist and bolted up past her to the door, claiming he had won. It was like they were back in high school again. When they opened the door, Ron saw all the blankets rumpled up near the fireplace and the cereal box and cans and cups laying on the floor. He looked in the kitchen and saw the oven door open. He wondered for a second who had been there, but then drew a quick breath as he recalled Billy's story about coming back to the camp before Mrs. Littlefield spotted him walking along the road. Ron tried to think how Billy could have survived at the camp with so little food for so long. It just wasn't enough food for him to eat from January to April. Maybe he'd found some more food. But where were the all the times Ron came out to look for him? Ron shuddered and shook it off. He figured he'd never know what really happened. "Billy, your breakfast is getting cold." Once again, Nana's voice came running up the stairs. Billy popped up, thinking he was late for school, and then remembered that he'd been given the day to skip. He smiled at himself and plopped back down. "Come on, Billy, don't let it get cold." "Okay, I'm coming." Nana was waiting. She had just finished watering and spraying her plants. When Billy opened the door at the bottom of the stairs, she hit him with a cool spray. "Hey, I'm not a flower," Billy laughed. He always woke up in a good mood. "Well, you're my little sweet petunia," Nana cooed. Billy shook his head and smiled and went back to his bacon and eggs and, yes, the cereal and all. They chatted about Mom and Dad and Grandpa's surprise, and they both knew what today was going to be about. Chapter 6, Transformation. So you were headed back to the house. William had told you about the lions, and you were going to choose a penny to bring William, Nana began, almost before Billy had finished his last sip of sweet milk at the bottom of his cereal bowl. Billy grinned a big grin, and even though they hadn't really talked in some time about his story, he picked up on it like it was yesterday. "Well, when we got back to the house, and we were about to go past the two lions, I tripped on a rock. Then I heard a deep voice. It was one of the lions, of course. 'You're always so clumsy. Pick up your feet. You're really awkward. All you left-handers are.' William had already gone up the stairs and was about to open the door, but he spun around real fast when he heard what the lion said. He told me not to pay any attention to what the lion said. That's what William said all the time, not to pay any attention to the lions. I ran up the stairs into the house. I thought I heard a little roar like a laugh, but I didn't look back. I just ran up to my room and started looking at the 12 paintings. I didn't know which one to pick for a long time. I just kept looking at them and looking at them, and finally I picked one. I went downstairs to find William and tell him that I had made a choice. Like I told you, this was a really big house. I couldn't find him and didn't see him anywhere. I looked in the library, in the den, in the kitchen. Then I went out to the big porch. William wasn't there, but Aaron was there. He was one of the people I met when I first came there. He was sitting in a big overstuffed chair, looking out over the water, listening to some music that was playing from somewhere. Now, I didn't think he heard me come out on the porch. I walked behind him. I was going to tap him on the shoulder and ask him if he knew where William had gone. But before I could say anything, he said something. Did you pick out a painting that you like? I told him that I liked them all, but I picked one out because William asked me to choose one. First, I started telling him what the one I picked out looked like, but before I could say anything, he knew. I guess you want to know about the painting called Transformation, right, Billy? That was really weird because that was the very painting I had picked. I wondered how he knew which one I had picked out so fast. Anyway, Aaron just stood up and started walking out of the room. He stopped, smiled, and motioned for me to follow him, and I did. We walked up the stairs to my room, and he went right over and took the painting off the wall. He turned it over, and on the back there was a little piece of paper with some words written on it. It was a poem, and Aaron read the words to me. They said, "We're not caterpillars, some species of butterfly communities, to be released for sudden flight as winged beauties overnight? Or are we? No photosynthesis permeates our being until we've had our fill, unearths us green with leafy frills abounding, to burst into bright colors until we spill upon the ground, then come around next spring red and gold and everything? No such thing. No pink and peach horizon within our reach. We are worker bees. Long live the queen." Or so it seems, but still we dream of transformation. After he had read the words, Aaron turned the painting back over and handed it to me. Then he asked me what I saw. Before I could answer anything at all, he asked me to look at the painting for 5 minutes before saying anything. Aaron was the youngest person there next to Anna. He was really friendly with everybody, and he laughed a lot. I thought he was probably 20-something. He had blonde hair and was pretty thin. He always seemed to be happy. Sometimes I would see him dancing all by himself, even if there wasn't any music playing. And when he was just walking around the house or while he was helping us at the table or something, he would sing out loud a lot. He couldn't sing very well, but that didn't seem to bother him or anyone else in the house at all. He'd just sing along and make everybody smile a lot. Oh, yeah, and he liked to whistle. You'd start to walk by him, and the next thing you knew, he'd have you... Did I say whistle? He'd like to wrestle. He'd have you on the floor or bounce you off the couch. And he always thought that was so hilarious. And he didn't do it just to me. He did it about everybody, even the old guys, because he was really gentle with them. And you could tell it was a way for him to make contact and let people know he cared about them. "It looks like a volcano or Mars or something," I finally said. "And there's this little plant just starting to grow back. What else do you see?" Aaron asked. When he asked me that, I looked back at the painting, and Nana, right before my eyes, the color in the paintings turned to this beautiful garden with all kinds of flowers and plants. That happened right while I was looking at the painting. It was like it was alive or a movie or something. I could see the flowers growing up and out of the ground and blooming, and bees flying from flower to flower. I could see this incredible sunrise, all pink and gold. There were colors like the colors of a peach, too. It was almost like I could smell the flowers and taste the peach. It was all so sweet and delicious. The whole thing made me feel so happy inside. As I watched all the colors move and the flowers grow and watched the bees that kept flying around from flower to flower, I saw the leaves on the trees start to change color. And then this beautiful ray of golden light came through the branches. When I saw this happen in the painting, it felt just like when I was in that big light right after I fell through the ice. It was the same feeling I had then, when that happened, with all the wonderful peacefulness inside, knowing that God knows me and loves me. And then I blinked and the painting went back to what I first saw. Aaron must have seen the look on my face because he just laughed and laughed and grabbed me and wrestled me to the floor. I tickled him to break free. When he let me go, he just rolled over and over across the floor like a little kid. How did you do that? I asked him. He just kind of looked at me funny, and that's what I was talking about. I knew that he knew what I was talking about. I told him what happened in the painting when he asked me to look at it again. Then he plopped down on the bed and just looked at me for the longest time. So you really saw it, huh? Aaron said. I just shook my head yes. After that, Aaron asked me to take a walk along the beach with him. As we walked, he started telling me about the transformation painting. I asked him if he was the one who painted the painting. He said he didn't paint it, but he knew the artist who did paint it. He told me that the artist used to walk the same beach we were walking on, and looking out to sea, he would ask God day after day why he was driven to paint paintings that he himself didn't understand, let alone anyone else. Aaron told me that the artist told him that one day, while he was going through his usual ranting and raving about his compulsion to paint, that he finally heard the answer inside. He said it was as if something told the painter that God would make his presence felt to some people who saw the artist's painting. Some people would feel the presence of God by just looking at a painting. When Aaron said that, I felt like I knew what God meant when he let the painter know the reason for his compulsion to paint his painting. Because that was what had happened to me. That's exactly what had happened to me when I looked at this painting. I felt God's presence from just looking at the painting. I didn't know a painting could do that, but now I do. I was also pretty sure that Aaron was the one who painted the painting, but he told me that he didn't. He told me that artists create their art to remind us, just from looking at their work, without words, that deep inside of all of us, even when we are really, really young, there's a sense that there's something really special about us. We feel it. Sometimes we feel it very strongly. Other times it's just a vague feeling. But most of the time, as we begin to grow up, we forget. And some people bury these feelings forever. It begins to happen when we are told to stop daydreaming and to pay attention to what we're being told and stuff like that. When we are taught that we need to be realistic and thoughtful at life, about life, and that the most important thing about life, we begin to lose touch with this feeling of being special. It's not that being realistic and thoughtful isn't good. It's just that when we give up our hopes and dreams and feelings of being special, so we will be thought of as realistic and thoughtful, we risk losing touch with who we really are meant to be. When we're taught the most important thing to be is like everyone else and think like everyone else and follow the rules like everyone else, we lose something of our special feeling. When we listen to people who gave up on their thoughts of being special for a long time ago and believe that they know better than we do, we are in danger of settling for a life that has lost its real meaning. We can give up on our potential for really enjoying life and lose our gratitude for the beautiful gift of life. We no longer believe in any new possibility that life holds in store for us. When this happens, we don't believe in or hope for transformation anymore. So we go to school and then to jobs, and we try to find that missing piece in relationships and new homes and cars and toys, but we still have this empty feeling. We become like worker bees, going to work, coming home, waiting to die. And we fill in the spaces with meaningless junk, and we know it. But we have not given up. Our dreams are gone, but not entirely. The spark remains. It just goes deep inside. Growing up, when we start hearing that we are a bad boy or a bad girl over and over, and we're told no over and over, we decide that we're not special at all. Instead, we begin to feel that we are not good and special, and something inside of us dies, or at least it goes to sleep. By the time we are just a few years old, we have been convinced that the world we first saw as awesome and beautiful and special and loving is really not the perfect and loving, benevolent place we thought. It is full of danger, and we have to watch out and be careful all the time. We're told that we have to watch out for so much that can hurt us. We have to pay attention and think carefully about what we're doing all the time. And so, after a while, we forget how to just be and just play. When we are newborn babies and little kids, we get lots of hugs and we hear grown-ups say how cute and adorable we are. Then, when we grow up a little bit, we begin to hear the negative stuff, like how bad we've been for not picking up our toys or silly stuff like that. It's not long before we give up on being special, and we give up hope of ever being special again. But we don't entirely give it up. Something inside continues to knock gently and say, yes, you are special. You can transform your life and recapture that wonderful reality. Some people learn to ignore that little voice almost all their lives. Some others become so beaten down and frightened that they never really listen again. And it seems like some people never give up on their dreams. They're the really strong and independent ones. And they go for it, no matter what anybody else says or thinks. Then there are those people who ignore that inner voice for a time, but then at some point in their life, they are drawn somehow to search for meaning, to dream once again, to search for something more. That's something they feel is missing in their life. Some people start to search when they're very young. Some people start when they're very old or even dying. Some search very quietly, and some search passionately. It's different for different people. Something as simple as watching a butterfly go by can start someone on their search and lead them to their eventual transformation. The sweet smell of a rose or a Sunday drive. Taking in the breathtaking colors of autumn leaves. Enjoying a beautiful sunrise or sunset. Or looking out over the ocean can spark someone's heart. Watching children play, listening to music, feeling a tender touch on the shoulder, or hearing loving words can do it, and even just looking at a painting can do it. This is really why painters paint, Aaron said. Even if they aren't conscious of why they paint, they create their art to touch people's hearts through what their eyes see and their mind knows intuitively. Their paintings are intended to point the way home to that special place once again. They are visual guides to bring the viewers beyond the nice warm feelings and sensations of the colors of the paintings and into the transformation of their hearts. Like Aaron said, and Picasso said also, by the way, the true artist is the one who creates art to express the presence of God in the living world. Aaron told me that maybe not many artists do this consciously. A lot of them are just making pretty pictures, but the true artist knows this part about God speaking to people and changing their hearts through the art they create. They may describe what they do differently, but it's the same thing in the final form. Very often, this search for transformation and renewed hope for something more in life or a chance to recapture their joy in living comes to people after a big mistake or a very painful experience in their life. A powerful event opens up to hope once more that there may be a lot more to life than they've decided to believe, and so they long for transformation of some sort. Someone who feels lost and hopeless or has a broken heart or feels really guilty about something they have done will sometimes suddenly be released to search for this transformation. It's like they've finally given up, and then when they do, their heart opens up. When life gets really tough or some event like an accident or an illness happens, some people decide that they have to change their lives by changing everything around them. They want their lives to be different. They want desperately to experience a dramatic change. It's like a bell goes off inside of them. But then sometimes they don't really look inside to make the change. Instead, they look at the things around them. It's like they don't really understand what's going on, but they know that things in their life are not right, and they want them to be different. But when they are really desperate and nothing else has worked, they will go deep inside and open to a new possibility. Then it is possible for a new reality to emerge, for their perspective to change, and for a transformation in their life to happen. Aaron said that out of the ashes of a volcano, in the middle of a rough, harsh, black, and gray lava, can spring new life. A tender green plant will pop up overnight, and the garden will come back to life, and the new growth and new beauty will change the entire landscape. Then he told me that all the other paintings and all the other stories of the paintings I would hear about would be about this transformation in one way or another. He told me that some of the people who would talk about the paintings would say some really scary and harsh things, but in the end, they would come to talk about the beautiful experience that is part of the human experience, transformation, available for everyone who seeks it. He told me about how much we change when this transformation happens to us. He said it's like we become a whole new person. People who need forgiveness feel absolutely forgiven for everything. People who had all these questions about their lives and about dying and about their relationships with other people suddenly feel as though all their questions have been either answered or have just gone away. What were big, important questions become unimportant, or they just disappear. We look at people very differently. People who used to upset us with some mannerism or personality that we didn't like, and now just love for who they are and whatever they do. Tolerance, Aaron called it. He even said we could melt people. My eyes must have gone pretty wide when he said that, because he burst out laughing when he looked at me. He explained that he meant we could soften people's attitudes, like a surly waiter or a rude taxi cab driver, with just the glow that comes from us and all the unconditional love we feel. He even said that the transformation we can experience makes us better dancers and singers. I wondered about this because Aaron wasn't really a good singer. Well, I guess he was okay. He was really nice and funny. He said that young people still in school would find their schoolwork much easier and a lot more fun. And then he told me that transformed people are more graceful in the way they move and are even better at sports. He explained to me that when we have peace of mind and we aren't worried about how things are going on in our life or how things are going to work out, that we are more physically relaxed as well, and that lets us move more gracefully. When we are not concerned with what other people think, we don't walk or move stiffly. We move naturally, and that's part of what makes us better dancers and athletes. Finally, he said that life would take on an easy and effortless flow. There would be this sense that everything will always work out for the best. Even mechanical things, like cars and things that need to be put together, would run better, work smoothly, and not break down as much. I don't know how a change of mind and heart can really change how a car runs, but that's what Aaron said. He told me that William would tell me more about the lines of fear and doubt, but he did say that once we experienced the transformation, we could control fear and doubt. Our mind would just be peaceful almost all the time. We wouldn't worry about what we should do and whether or not we should do something, how would we feel if we did it, or how would we feel if we didn't do something. We would just know and trust ourselves, he said. And we would trust in a kindness in life, in nature, and what he called a kind creator. It sounded like he was saying that just looking at the painting we were talking about could do this. And then at other times, it seemed like he was talking about what happened to me when I fell through the ice. Either way, it all just seemed natural and true to me. I don't know why, but I felt like I knew exactly what he was talking about. So that was Aaron's story about the first painting I picked out. It was really fun. Then he told me that the reason for all the other different paintings and all the different stories is because different people respond to different things and life lessons. He said he hoped that I would remember the stories well because there are so many people waiting to hear the stories and see the paintings. Aaron looked at the painting one last time and put it back up on the wall. As he walked by me on his way out of my room, he picked me up and tossed me on the bed. Then he ran downstairs, laughing his head off. "Just show them the paintings," he shouted back to me. "But how can you show anyone the paintings, Billy, when you don't have the paintings?" Nana asked, finally breaking the captivating spell she had been under, listening to Billy. "Oh, I'm supposed to paint them," Billy said almost nonchalantly. "From memory?" Nana said, like she couldn't believe what she heard. "From God," Billy replied simply. Well, believe it or not, and not many people would, but at this point, Nana was speechless. Billy then told her that he had a lot more stories. He said he had listened to a lot more stories from the other people of the castle, one for each painting in his room. But he asked Nana if she didn't want to hear just one story about one painting in one day. She agreed that this was a good idea. That would give her time to really think about each story. Billy told Nana that the other 11 people at the castle all talked like Aaron did about art and music and God and religion and spiritual things. And he told her that they talked about philosophy and relationships and morals and ethics and economics and choices we make in life. Excuse me. Well, as you can imagine, Nana couldn't believe her ears. Here was an innocent 10-year-old boy, her grandson, who, only a few months ago, thought mostly about fishing and climbing trees and reading comic books. Now here he was talking to her about the true meaning of art, and about religion, economics, and philosophy. She was stunned, as you can imagine. "Nana, can I go now? I think I'm just going to take a walk out to Panther Rock," Billy asked as he touched Nana's shoulder gently. Nana just nodded acknowledgement. She was already in deep thought about what Billy had told her this morning. So Billy headed out to Panther Rock. Panther Rock was one of Billy's quiet places, just a couple of hundred yards or so from the house tucked away on the edge of the woods. It was a rock formation about 10 feet high that had been discovered by Billy a few years earlier. He would sit in a little nook and watch as panthers very stealthily strolled by his hiding place. Of course, there aren't really any panthers in Maine, but as you know, Billy had a great imagination. He loved the movies, and he often came out of the theater totally into the role of one of the characters in the movie he had just seen. Billy had always admired quiet strength and courage, so if one of the hero characters caught his fancy, he was off and running. There was something about assuming a role and becoming detached from reality that he liked. He also liked being hidden from sight, watching other people interact. That was another thing that he found very appealing. He thought about being invisible would be a wonderful advantage, and the thought often crossed his mind. As he climbed up on Panther Rock, he slipped into that quiet place, that silent state of mind he had come to know so well. He had become familiar with it as a little kid, playing alone out in the woods and fields. He would let his imagination take over, and he would transform into a stealthy hunter of cougars, wolves, wild boar, and other thoroughly dangerous animals. Sometimes he would become an Indian scout, moving unheard and unseen as he closed in on a campfire blazing in the night in the Old West. From his unseen and unknown hiding place, he could listen to plans and learn secrets not meant for his eyes and ears. He became very good at these sound games. At other times, he would become an animal himself with awesome strength. He would become that panther, which stalk its prey so patiently and silently before making a cat-quick pounce from the darkness. And many times, he would be the pursued. He was an escapee from prison who had devised some incredibly clever way to spring himself free, and the hounds were on his trail. He would crisscross the brook a dozen times, leap from rock to rock, and even crush berries in his footprints and on rocks to throw his hounds off the scent. One of his favorite roles was the role of Robin Hood. Billy loved the stories of Robin Hood, the sheriff of Nottingham, and his men were often after him. When they were, he would hide under the leaves of fallen trees or branches, or else climb high into a huge maple tree and watch the men and the horses ride by him underneath. But there was one thing that bothered Billy in these games. Whenever he found a hiding place in the deep quiet of the woods, he could hear the sound of his excited, quick, short breaths, and he knew this would give him away if anyone came close enough to hear him, even if he made himself invisible. Once settled into the perfectly smooth, hollowed-out place in Panther Rock, Billy focused on staying absolutely still. Only his eyes moved as he scanned the nearby woods. His hearing was finely tuned to pick up any sound of movement, but there was not a sound to be heard. No panthers today. As Billy sat quietly and listened more and more carefully, trying to pick up on the slightest sound, it suddenly occurred to him that even his breathing was absolutely silent. Before his winter experience, he had always breathed in short, quick breaths that he could hear on both the inhale and exhale. Now he was breathing much more gently and deeply, and his breathing made absolutely no sound whatsoever. He took a quick look at his hands to make sure he hadn't become invisible. When he saw his hands, he was both relieved and a little disappointed. In the next instant, something new slipped into his mind. It felt very, very close to the sensation he had when he first entered the light after falling through the ice. He had the most vivid sense he had ever had of really being invisible. He realized that who he really was, the Billy deep inside, the Billy he had discovered in the light, was indeed invisible. He felt more alive, in a sense, than he ever had in his life. It was a fleeting feeling, and it passed quickly, but it left a glow. As he sat for several minutes enjoying how he now breathed so gently and silently, he flashed back to his time with William. William talked to Billy a lot about silence.